You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It was 1823. The land of Michigan wasn't yet a state. The indigenous people far outnumbered white settlers. The Erie Canal hadn't opened yet. The flood of European immigrants was yet to arrive. But the groundwork for their arrival was set in 1823 by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case about property rights. For the second story in our series, An Idea on the Land, Dustin Dwyer tells us about Johnson versus McIntosh.
On the fourth floor of the Michigan State University Law School building, on a windowsill that overlooks the campus, Winona Singel keeps her family photos. Singel is a law professor here and associate director of MSU's Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Family is the reason she went to law school, she says. When she was young, she was separated from her sister in what she says was a coerced adoption. It's a familiar story in many Native families.
And it's something that I wanted to understand more deeply. And in my mind, understanding the operation of our legal system and the development of federal Indian law and policy was absolutely critical.
So when she got older, she went to law school at Harvard. In the first year, all Harvard law students had to take a class on property law. That is where Winona Singel first heard of the landmark case known as Johnson v. McIntosh.
The original Johnson of the case was actually a former Supreme Court justice and a wealthy shareholder in the Illinois and Wabash Land Company. And this land company had speculated in the purchase of Indian lands.
It purchased those lands directly from the tribes. And at that same time, the federal government was out trying to get land from tribes. It negotiated treaties with the tribes. And once the government got the land, it would parcel it out to sell to settlers. So along comes this settler named McIntosh. He buys from the government. But the land he buys, it's already been bought by the Illinois and Wabash Land Company. Remember, that's the group of wealthy investors that buys directly from the tribes, and Johnson is a part of that group. So Johnson bought from the tribe. McIntosh bought from the U.S. government. The question before the Supreme Court, who really owned the land now? Johnson or McIntosh? It's an easy question if you think the tribe owned its land in the first place. Because if the tribe owned it, it could sell it to the Illinois and Wabash Land Company, Johnson's group. Johnson wins. But the real question was whether the tribe owned the land in the first place. Did they even have the power to sell it?
And to the surprise of the lawyers and shareholders in the Illinois and Wabash Land Company, Justice Marshall in the Johnson v. McIntosh case declared that the tribes did not have this power and that they only had the power to transfer their property directly to the federal government.
McIntosh won the case because he had bought from the federal government. And Justice Marshall argued the federal government was the true owner of the land all along. The indigenous people of the U.S. had some rights on their land. They had the right to use it and occupy it. But they couldn't sell it on the open market because they didn't really own it. Yes, the U.S. government said Native people did not actually own the land they'd lived on for thousands of years. And yes, this decision had a huge impact. If and when Native people ever did want to sell their land rights, there was only one buyer they could turn to. That meant the buyer had the upper hand in the negotiations over price. It was a rigged deal. Singel learned all this as a busy, stressed first-year law student.
And then you move on to the next case. And there's no further discussion about the wrong that this perpetuates, and also the flawed reasoning, and also fundamentally misinformed and racist presumptions that our property legal system is based upon.
And this isn't some obscure case. It's foundational in the U.S. legal system. Most law schools teach it to all their students in the first year.
In many ways, it's almost like gaslighting. You're learning about certain rights that are associated with property rights, the right of possession, the right to exclude, the right to transfer, knowing all along that these rights have not been respected and were not enforced for your own ancestors.
One of the passages in the actual text of the Supreme Court decision reads like this. Quote, "The tribes of Indians inhabiting this country were fierce savages whose occupation was war and whose subsistence was drawn chiefly from the forest. To leave them in possession of their country was to leave the country a wilderness." End quote. This language and the precedent it established has never been overturned in America's legal system. It is valid law today.
Imagine if Plessy v. Ferguson was never overturned. Imagine if Dred Scott was never overturned. Right? We've never had any kind of accounting and justice that has restored those original property rights.
After Johnson v. McIntosh, the early white settlers of Michigan drafted a series of treaties with the native people of the area. These documents would have the tribes sign their land over to the federal government. Lewis Cass was Michigan's second governor. He negotiated a number of the treaties. In the late 1820s, he advocated for the forced removal of the land's native people. In his argument, he echoed the words of Justice Marshall. He claimed if white people didn't rule the land, Michigan would be doomed to, quote, perpetual unproductiveness, end quote. Cass didn't get his wish for removal, but he did eventually get the treaties. And the white people did make the land productive in their way. The same as they had done in all of the Americas, says Willie Jennings of Yale Divinity School. They did what they believed their God wanted them to do.
The way they looked at the land from the very beginning, from Michigan to Maine, from Virginia to Florida, they looked at the land as the world in potential that needed development. And that development was always tied to what can be taken from the land.
In Michigan, a land of dense ancient forests, they could take a lot.
That was Dustin Dwyer. Tomorrow he'll continue his series, An Idea on the Land, with part 3, The Story of Trees.